Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
The American Family Association's mission is to inform, equip, and activate individuals to strengthen the moral foundations of our culture. Our goal is to be a leading organization in biblical worldview training for cultural transformation. We stand on the biblical truth that all human beings, including the unborn, are created in the image of God and are endowed by Him with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Thank you for standing with the American Family Association.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, November 20th, and the GOP just continues to sink to new depths that I didn't think possible. Like, have you seen that? I think it's on Instagram. It's like that video that shows how deep the ocean actually is, and it goes like layer by layer, and it gets darker and darker, and you think that, wow, this must be like the floor, this must be the absolute bottom, and then it keeps going down like 10 levels below that. That's basically where we're at with this GOP Congress, and the latest failure, and just and it's just a ridiculous one, because I think the Republicans forgot somehow that they're actually in the majority and they actually have power, especially in the House of Representatives, and they can do some things. They don't want to govern. We know that. And it's just pathetic. But the latest failure is a failed effort in the House of Representatives to censure Democrat delegate Stacey Plaskett over her text exchanges with Jeffrey Epstein during a 2019 congressional hearing. And this is just so beyond the pale. And the only reason, because she absolutely deserved censure, I think she deserves expulsion for this and possibly a criminal investigation. But the failure of the GOP to censure her, the bare minimum, is because for the second time, they are trying to save Representative Corey Mills out of Florida. Yes, unfortunately, out of Florida. And there's a really good thread on X, if you want to read it, by our friend Will Chamberlain. And he posted it yesterday, and he said, re-upping this lengthy thread that he actually posted on September 18th, that is talking about all of the different allegations against Corey Mills. And the whole bottom line here is that Corey Mills is being accused of stolen valor, not actually having won a or been awarded a Bronze Star medal, among other things, including there were police reports and, you know, allegations of abuse and actually pimping out his girlfriend at the time. I mean, a lot of stuff that is just so beyond what anybody in the GOP should stand for if we are remotely a party that even pretends to stand on principles. But I don't think that we do anymore. I think that the GOP is perfectly happy to be in the minority and say, well, you know what, we won't censure your bad behavior, Democrats, if you won't vote to censure us. Why not censure both? Why not say it doesn't matter whether there is an R or a D after your name? If it is bad censurable behavior, then maybe no one is above the law. Haven't we heard that for a really long time? And actually censure both. And it doesn't matter what party they're from. And I could continue this rant, but let's welcome on Steve Dace, who is, of course, a radio host at The Blaze and a prolific ranter as well. And Steve, I just am so frustrated with the GOP because it's like they don't care that the American people handed them the trifecta and actually expected them to govern. I mean, that's literally the bare minimum.
Well, on a micro level, Jenna, on this Corey Mills front, this one hits close to home because the woman who unraveled this sweater literally grew up listening to me on the radio here in Iowa. And then eventually, you know, followed my career path, starting in sports and then transferring to politics. And you just finished the last few years working with me at the Blaze. And it's my friend and colleague, Jill Savage. Mm. And I mean, Corey Mills was married in his first marriage. The officiant was an imam who's an unindicted co-conspirator from 9/11. This guy takes random trips to Syria, as one does, you know, it's,
right.
This entire thing on a micro level, just the only conclusion I can come to with Corey Mills is listen, I've seen texts. I've had the kinds of texts that are episodes of House of Cards. And if they made their way to me in Iowa, where do you think, how many other people all over D.C. have seen these? So I think when you see stories like Corey Mills, or you see things, and I'm just going to say it, because it's inexplicable. I mean, if we took the Wonder Woman lasso of truth and put it around Cash Patel, and put it around every right-wing influencer that we know with a blue check mark and say, what do you think of the job Cash Patel's done his first year as FBI director? Everybody, if they had to tell the truth, they'd all say it's a disappointment. His body language is often terrible. At this point, I think how is it possible that the Blaze is telling us more about the January 6th pipe bomber that the Democrats claimed existed then never solved? How is it possible Tucker Carlson is telling us more about Thomas Matthew Crooks than Cash Patel has? When there's no good answers to these questions and it involves your team, then I think you just need to assume that at this point, this person either is, you have two choices, that in the case of Cash Patel, or in this case with the Republicans in Congress, they are really just this bad at this and this naive and this completely worked over by sinister forces that are just way more cunning than they are, or there's so much blackmail material to go around here that it's mutual assured destruction and everybody just decides to cover for everybody else. And I'm going to tell you right now, it's going to almost always be the latter one, almost every single time, because no other explanations work. The reality is Corey Mills is a largely nondescript member of Congress that they could replace at any particular point in time. Instead, they're going to hold on to him and maybe cost themselves a congressional seat next year as a result. What if they just got rid of him now? No one would care if he was Corey Mills, Donna Mills, General Mills. No one would care. He said Democrats are going to make that district care all of next year, and they may end up losing that congressional seat as a result of that. So why make these kinds of decisions? You only make these kinds of decisions because you have a double-digit IQ, and I know we want to believe this. We've had this moniker on our side, the evil party versus the stupid party. And I think sometimes what we conflate as stupidity is, listen, if you sent me out to be an evangelist for Islam, I know I've read the Quran, I've studied it intently, but, you know, it's not personal to me. I've not absorbed it. I'm not an adherent. So, you know, I could fake my way through it on a surface level intellectually because I know enough to be dangerous. But if you made me really own it, like pay a price for it, that I couldn't do and I wouldn't be any good at. And I look stupid doing it because I really don't believe in it. I think that's really what we call stupidity most of the time, is we've elected a bunch of people for various reasons, our own laziness, or we just even participate in the primary process for essentially a generation. And therefore, we got a bunch of people elected on our talking points who really don't share our worldview and values. That's what we call stupidity, when really it's treachery. And then in many other cases, so many of these people are so compromised. I can't tell you how many friends of mine in D.C. I've heard from that are just like, listen, I will go out to some guy friends for a drink. I'll jump in an Uber, and a very attractive woman I don't know just jumps in it right with me. And it's just a very clear honeypot. Or they think I'm gay, and a very attractive guy just jumps in the back of the car with me, you know, and asks me, hey, it's very clear what's going on here. And I just think you have to assume that there's just too much blackmail material on way too many of these people. Corey Mills could not be doing, could not have accomplished. If you know the whole tale here in this story here, there's just no way he can do this and get into the sectors that he's connected to and have access to the places, the high-rise apartments, the money. He can't get there on his own. So who's getting him there? What's the connective tissue? And I think you just have to assume that so many other elements are in, what do you want to call them, deep state, whatever you want to call it, are involved in elevating people like this, that either the guy is a spy or he is one of our own intelligence assets and just got caught literally with his zipper down. And so they're protecting him because there's a wider scheme in place that they don't want exposed. I think the same thing's probably true with Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, why, you know, Mike Johnson saying yesterday there's classified stuff. Why would, unless someone's an intelligence asset of any kind, why would a sex fiend's crimes be classified? Name me any other serial sex fiend whose crimes are classified, unless there's some kind of intelligence operation involved here. And so I think people at this point would just be wise to just assume when folks continually do things that on the surface don't make any sense and on the surface don't serve their political interests. Because you're right, it would look great for the GOP. Get rid of this nondescript congressman, replace him with somebody probably better in the same district before Democrats do it, and then turn around and pivot and make the whole thing about Epstein, you know, literally this Democrat congresswoman taking dictation from Jeffrey Epstein during a committee hearing. That's political gold. You're right. So why won't they do it? It's more than likely they have to protect Mills because whatever he was involved in, he got several of the other knuckle-dragging, low-character integrity Republicans around him involved, and they've got to protect each other now. It's more likely that.
Which is so disappointing, goes all the way back to 2015 and Donald Trump being the outsider saying, let's drain the swamp. I mean, this is literally the swamp that he was talking about. And so why hasn't it been drained? Because we are a year into the second Trump administration and everybody promised that, you know, especially during the primary, right? Everybody promised that when Donald Trump came back and yeah, he only has 4 years, he's not going to be the lame duck and he'll go in there guns blazing because he has now seen the effects and he knows better this time, et cetera, all of that rhetoric. And am I glad he's there instead of Kamala Harris? Absolutely. However, 2028 is looming and Republicans writ large are actually no better off in terms of gaining support, nor should they be, based on what has happened over this last year. And I'm seeing so much in the political world, as I know you are, Steve, from people who are incredibly disappointed with the lack of governance from everybody and frustrated, and I think rightly, with Trump for just giving away this whole Epstein nonsense from day one and allowing that to derail his first year instead of just saying, coming right out of the gate and saying, I don't care. Yeah, I'm leaving it to the DOJ. Do whatever you want. I'm focused on actually winning for the American people. He could have so easily sidestepped that issue. Yet so here we are in the midst of all of this.
Why didn't he do that? You need to ask yourself, then why didn't he do that?
Exactly. Right.
And I think the only
suspicious
answer, you credible answer you can come to is it's very clear there are wider associations involving Jeffrey Epstein that now that he's got to make the poll and he's got to make the chart, he's got to make the call, he's concerned, get in the way of what he overall wants to do. That's exactly why. Listen, man, I think Jenna, you are, if anybody who's been around me for 5 minutes knows what I think about low-T, incel, double-digit IQ, retarded anti-Semitism. I think you see me on a regular basis take this on, right? Don't you see this on a regular basis?
Mm-hmm.
I club this all the time. I have... And it kills my engagement. Listen, other than doing porn, the number one thing you can do to grow your social media presence in the United States of America in the year 2025, regardless of platform, all right, is bat your eyelashes at Nick Fuentes and Grapers and anti-Semitism. All right, all of the social media sites just can't get enough of it. Silicon Valley is drunk on the Jews tropes. That being said, okay, I mean... I, at this point, I think that if you do the math, the most likely scenario is Jeffrey Epstein was some kind of combined Mossad CIA asset. It is the only thing that makes any sense if you do the math. And I'm a truth guy. The only, and of course, this would be like the worst time for that truth to come out, because we do have a massive influx of anti-Semitism right now on both sides of the political aisle. And all, and boy, could you just imagine the kerosene to the kindling that that narrative would be, okay? That essentially our combined intelligence operations protected this guy for years.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and Steve, the music came early today, so I want to have you back on to talk about this, because I actually think that Israel isn't the focus as much. Like, it's not the actual topic as much as it is to rid the establishment GOP and especially marginalized evangelicals of any sort of influence. And I wish we had more time. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And now that the government is actually open, even though we've been talking about how Congress, at least on the House side, doesn't seem to want to actually govern, let's hope that the Senate, at bare minimum, will have some judicial confirmations that will make a meaningful impact. Because regardless of what else happens over the next 3 years of Trump's presidency, like his first administration, I think that the judicial appointees can and likely will be his greatest legacy and from his first term. And I think they can and will be from his second term if the Senate is willing to act. And Mitch McConnell, for everything else, was really a hero of the first administration for shepherding a lot of those through. We've seen the difference that it's made on the U.S. Supreme Court. And now the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit has an opening, and President Trump has an opportunity to identify a strong constitutionalist nominee for the Eighth Circuit. And according to our vice president here at the American Family Association, Aaron Morrow Hawley is that nominee. So good morning, Walker, and tell us a little bit more about Aaron Hawley, who is the wife of Senator Josh Hawley, by the way.
Yeah, that's right, Jenna. This vacancy came open in late October 24th, to be specific. And this is, once again, a vacancy that President Trump can fill. And before I get into Aaron Hawley, I've got to say the Senate is moving pretty quickly on these nominees. I think there was lessons learned on how the Democrats had stalled some of the nominees to begin with in the first term. And so lessons learned there. And so these nominees are moving pretty quickly in the Senate. And so so that's encouraging. They're announcing these nominees and then having hearings within a couple of days, which is usually unheard of. Usually there's weeks before hearings, and then they're moving them to the Senate floor within a couple weeks after that. So that's good news. And then the other thing is that Aaron Hawley is who we've researched, and we've even researched Aaron Hawley even prior to this vacancy on the Eighth Circuit because we knew her extensive litigation career and her constitutional background. So to give a little bit of history on Aaron Hawley, she's an Alliance Defending Freedom attorney. She's worked with ADF for many years. She's also worked with multiple other litigation firms, most of them in the civil arena. She's argued before the Supreme Court and multiple lower courts, including circuit courts as well. And so a couple of decades she's been in the legal fight, and she shares our worldview. And that's very important to us as we do our research. And so, yes, as you mentioned, Aaron Hawley is the wife of Senator Josh Hawley. So it is a bit of an unusual circumstance, but there's nothing prohibiting Aaron Hawley from serving and being appointed by the president for this position.
Absolutely. And you hope then that with her husband in the Senate, she has at least his vote, if not, enough to get that appointment. And, you know, you mentioned she shares our worldview. That is incredibly important. And we've seen that in the identification that that AFA at least has made on the action side in terms of the green list of judges, and some lessons learned, I think, from conservatives as well of not just looking necessarily to pedigree or, you know, some of these other vetting processes that we've done in the past. And then these judges get appointed to the bench and they end up either moderate or actually terrible judges. And so how has at least AFA Action, and I think in collaboration with a few other similarly minded and Christian advocacy groups, how have we changed our analysis in terms of recommendations to the Senate on specifically judicial appointments?
Yeah, to your point, what we've learned is it doesn't matter who you know or who you hang out with or which groups you're a part of and which, you know, speeches you give at these various banquets and receptions and dinners that are hosted by these law groups. What matters is what have you done in your career? And more specifically, are there instances where you've had to display courage as a judge or as an attorney? And so we're really looking for people who've been in the fire, if you will, who've been under pressure, and let that show. And also, what's their worldview? Because you alluded to this, but this has been an area, it's really been a black hole in the conservative legal movement over the last 40 years, and even before that, probably going back to Reagan, where we can't look at worldview, right? Because, well, worldview and religion shouldn't affect their rulings. They should just be looking at the black letter of the law. Well, yeah, in a non-fallen world, that makes perfect sense. But we do live in a fallen world, and people have biases, and people have worldviews, and they allow their worldview to shape their legal thinking. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. That's just how things work. And so we began looking at their faith and worldview, the faith and worldview of these prospective judges, because you can't say that someone, for example, is a Christian, but they're not going to let that influence their judicial rulings. Like, what kind of Christian doesn't let their faith and worldview impact their judicial rulings? And so it's really a non-realistic standard that had been set prior, where we can't look at faith and worldview because it doesn't matter. And so we're looking at that now, and it helps us very much. I mean, for example, if you have a judicial nominee that goes to a pro-LGBTQ quote-unquote church, well, that's not good. That's not very good when it comes to how they're going to roll on that issue, because clearly they have a soft spot and a sympathy for that issue. So that's just one example. And then, you know, if, for example, there's a nominee that's an atheist, that's an avowed atheist that doesn't even believe in God, well, how's that going to work out when they're ruling on the First Amendment, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, and the right to life? I mean, these are core Christian tenets. And so faith and worldview do matter. So that's just one area that we're looking at amongst others.
Yeah, and I'm sitting with Walker Wildman, of course, who's a vice president here at the American Family Association and hosts At the Core on American Family Radio. And you can listen to past episodes like all of our great shows at AFR.net. And it's so important for worldview to come into the picture, especially with how much the social issues in a broad way, are coming up before the U.S. Supreme Court. And we've seen that worldview clash in just the way that the different judges even approach the issues. Because if you come at the law and the Constitution as a social compact that can be modified and that needs to bend and flex with a new era and whatever the consensus of the majority is or whatever you think it is, then that's how you should rule. That's a very different framework than an originalist judge that says our rights come from God, our creator. There is a fixed moral premise for society. We cannot change the laws of nature and of nature's God. It is his authority that's delegated to a legitimate government. And so the government is obligated to preserve and protect those rights for all human beings. I mean, there's such a vast difference, Walker, and even just in that, you know, 10-second explanation, and it obviously goes well beyond that, that I think a lot of people have been conditioned, especially in law school. I mean, that's what they teach. Unfortunately, in law school, conditioned to say, well, if we secularize and the whole judiciary, then that means it will be without bias. And I think that's a total lie that we have to dismantle.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to your point about what's happening in America's law schools, I mean, you know this well, many of them aren't even teaching the Constitution, at least the original text of the Constitution. For example, you go to a constitutional law class, you know, you're not going to read the Bill of Rights. Maybe that may be like a footnote in your studies, but you're going to be looking at what they call case law and how other judges have ruled and interpreted the Constitution over the years, and in this case, over the centuries. The problem with that, as it, at its core, is that judges get it wrong. And so you can't just look at case law and go, well, this is precedent, and, you know, this is the consensus amongst, you know, lawyers over the last, you know, two plus centuries. You have to look at the original intent, the writings of the founding fathers. What did they mean when they wrote this? What was the context in which they wrote it? What are their writings even outside of the Constitution itself? What did some of these founding fathers write and commentate about the Constitution? And so all of that needs to be factored in. And when you do that properly, and when people properly understand the Constitution as it was written, it's really a radically different view of what we have today. I mean, many of us understand the original intent, and so we can tell you what they meant by it. But if we were to start applying original intent to our rulings today, it would look radically different than what we've seen over recent centuries. And so our goal is to take America back to those founding ideals and to really restore the judiciary to its proper place. And one more thing I'll mention, Jenna, and then we can move on. But the Supreme Court was never intended to be the spectacle that it is today. And when I say spectacle, I mean this kind of center stage, end-all, be-all, you know, every dispute's got to be decided by the nine justices. And, you know, if you win, you're on top of the mountain, and if you lose, you feel like your rights are being taken away. Our founders didn't intend that. The court actually, when the Supreme Court first began in the early years of the country, they didn't even have a building to then. They actually had to share the Continental Congress. They had to share the congressional building there in Washington, D.C. And so John Jay, I mentioned this yesterday on my program, John Jay was an ambassador to a nation in Europe. I forget it off the top of my head. But John Jay was asked by George Washington to come back and serve on the Supreme Court. And John Jay actually questioned whether it was important enough or not. He was like, hey, I'm this ambassador. I'm really important. I'm making a big difference, and you want me to come back and serve on the lowly Supreme Court? Because at the time, the Supreme Court wasn't ruling on all these nationwide issues. They were narrowly focused on just a handful of jurisdictions that they could rule on, and it really wasn't this fancy job. It wasn't a desired position. It was kind of this afterthought. And so we really need to get the courts back to that place where they're not sought after by everyone and every you know, entity to resolve America's disputes. We've got to resolve these issues at the lower courts and within the states.
Absolutely. So well said. And I think it's so important that we, as an overarching conservative movement, focus on getting the judiciary, especially the federal judiciary, back to its proper role, because you're absolutely right that constitutionally and per the text of Article 3, which is, you know, obviously why they call them Article 3 judges, but that explain the role of the federal judiciary. They don't have unlimited jurisdictional authority to hear whatever cases they deem important enough or that they just want to rule on for the entire country. We are supposed to live in a federalist system where there can be a difference between the states on issues that affect everyday Americans. And guess what, if you don't like it in New York or California, well, hey, you can move to Florida. That's literally what I did. I didn't like what was going on in Colorado, so I moved to Florida. And you can, if you're insane, you can do the reverse. But, you know, we don't see all the U-Hauls going into California. We only see them coming out. But the point here is that the federal judiciary is actually has a role of limited jurisdiction, and they have assumed so much more, especially in the last 50 to 60 years, than the founders ever gave them and that the text of the U.S. Constitution ever provided. And we're seeing this with so many of these rogue judges that Democrats who want to perpetuate lawfare go and forum shop. And they look for judges that will sign off on these things, like what we're seeing with the Arctic Frost investigation, where these judges signed off on surveillance of sitting members of Congress, on Trump allies and associates. And I mean, there could be so many examples of judges overstepping their role. I mean, even to the same-sex marriage decision that should be overturned. That went well beyond the federal jurisdiction. We don't get federal marriage licenses. States can determine for themselves according to their own state constitution. And 31 states said marriage is between one man and one woman. And so that should not be overridden by an overreaching federal government. So, Walker, we need to impeach more of these judges. And I've been saying for a while that even though I don't think we'll get to the two-thirds majority right now with the Senate composition, and that's a problem to actually convict and remove, I would still be in favor of putting up some of these really egregious examples like Judge Boasberg and others, at least to have to defend themselves in front of the American people in a trial in the Senate. And I think the more that we do this, at least the more transparency will be shown. And we can do for the judiciary basically what we did with DOJ, which is just shine a light on how much the corruption is actually there. Because I really don't think that the American people writ large understand just what a problem all of these rogue judges are.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to your point, as far as what's the solution here, there's really only a handful of options. I mean, you've got the impeachment option, for the legislative branch, for the Congress, where you've got to have two-thirds. That's an option. Another option that's more, you know, realistic, if you will, in the short term, is to appoint judges that understand their role. And that's what President Trump is doing, and that's why we're trying to research these nominees, is because if you have a judge that understands his or her proper role as a judge and what their jurisdiction is, then some of this can be self-corrected. For example, you can have the Supreme Court that says, no, we're not going to take that case up because we just don't have jurisdiction over it. That's an ideal scenario. That's probably the quickest order to get some of this resolved. But ultimately, Congress needs to use its authority. And at a minimum, Jenna, even if we know going into it, hey, we're not really going to be able to impeach this judge, we just don't have the votes, at a minimum, you open an inquiry and have a hearing and force the judge to testify before Congress on their rulings. Give a defense for your rulings. Tell us your constitutional reasoning, if there is any, and let's talk about it. But we're not even having that conversation. And so I think if you start applying pressure and bringing just a handful of these rogue judges before Congress to testify on their impeachment inquiry, that's going to really put a lot of pressure on other judges to really think twice before they rule unconstitutionally.
Absolutely, because right now it seems like they think they're pretty insulated, because the worst that will happen is that maybe they're overturned later, or in some cases, you know, a year or two when the media isn't even paying attention to it. And so they feel very insulated in their position, because federal judges are a lifetime tenure. And we need to have good behavior in the Constitution, which is what it says, you know, a lifetime tenure on good behavior. We need to actually take that definition and make it have impact legally and substantively, and not just presume that these are petty little dictators, basically, from their chambers that can rule however they want and go outside the bounds of the Constitution however they want without consequence. And so to your point, though, Walker, if we can get as many judges as possible on the bench and basically start pushing out, you know, any of the bad appointments, eventually all judges will have to retire at some point. So if we can get the most good in and we continue to fill the bench with good constitutionalist judges, then hopefully we can foreclose a lot of this for the future. But that also requires continuing to vote in elections that matter, and to have presidents in place that understand this. And so this really is a constitutional republic if we can keep it one day and one judicial nominee and one presidency at a time. And I think that for conservatives, we can't just rest on our laurels of saying, well, we really won a big mandate in 2024. We always have to be looking to the next election. And if we had more senators in place that would be willing to actually look at impeachment and conviction, that might be a more viable option. I mean, all of these things taken together matter. And this is why we focus so much on all of the individual pieces, because I think people need to recognize how important every single aspect of using our our rights and power as citizens in this country to select and prefer leaders that will act in accordance with the biblical worldview and legitimate government.
Yeah, we've got to have control in Washington for more than just 4 years at a time. To your point, we're going to have, I think, to make a true lasting impact, we probably need 8 to 12 years of consecutive leadership in the White House. And we have to maintain control of the Senate as well, because the Senate has to advise and consent on these nominees. And so the Senate and the White House, and of course we need the whole Congress as well. But this is why every election is important.
Yeah, well said. All right, well, we'll take a break here. Walker Wildman, really appreciate it. And this is why these positions are so important. But it is actually really good news and encouraging that the Senate is moving fast on these. Again, this may be the one really good thing that comes out of the second Trump administration and having a Senate that's in place that will move quickly on some of these, because judges, probably federal judges more than anything, other than codifying some of Trump's executive orders, will have the most lasting impact for generations to come. And we need to have judicial reform in a lot of different ways. So be praying for that appointment and for all of the judges that are good to move swiftly through a confirmation in the Senate. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. We're living in a time when truth is under attack. Lies are easy to tell, easy to spread, and easy to believe. But truth? Truth is costly. And nowhere is the cost greater than for mothers in crisis. When a woman is told abortion is her only option, silence and lies surround her. But when she walks into a preborn network clinic, she's met with compassion, support, and the truth about the growing life inside her. That moment of truth happens through a free ultrasound, and it's a game changer. When a mother sees her baby and hears that heartbeat, it literally doubles the chance she will choose life. Preborn Network clinics are on the front lines, meeting women in their darkest hour, loving them, helping them choose life, and sharing the truth. Friend, this is not the time to be silent. It is the time for courage, for truth, and for life. Just $28 provides one ultrasound and the opportunity for a mother to see her baby to help her choose truth and choose life. Please donate today. Call #250 and say baby. That's #250 baby, or give online at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, as we have talked about, elections have consequences and elections matter. And one of the biggest elections in the country that is happening next November is, of course, the election for Florida's governor and who will succeed Governor Ron DeSantis in the free state of Florida. And this is so important because Florida has, for the 8 years of Governor Ron DeSantis, been the example, and I think the beacon of light to other states, and especially the other red states, to say, hey, we are setting the standard of what it means to win, what it means to fight the fights that need fighting, and to show what state sovereignty can actually do to make life better and more free and have genuine ordered liberty for the residents of Florida. And you've seen that by how many people have moved to this state because of Ron DeSantis's leadership. I'm one of them. I love the free state of Florida. I want to see all of these great policies continue. And so Paul Renner, who was the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives during the 2022-2024 term, and is also a U.S. Navy veteran, former prosecutor, and business attorney, is also running for governor, and he joins us now. And Paul, I had an opportunity, actually, as I was speaking in South Carolina with Alex McFarland, who's here at AFR, and our listeners know him. One of your very close friends actually came up to me and was just singing your praises and saying, you know, you got to meet Paul Renner. And I'd wanted to have you on anyway. And so that was just one of those moments, though, where I thought, you know, this is why the good leaders in Florida just go well beyond the borders of Florida, because he could just not stop talking about, you know, how amazing you'd done as Speaker of the House. So I'm looking forward to meeting you in person one day, but thank you so much for joining this morning, and tell us more about your vision for carrying on the DeSantis legacy.
Well, I was Speaker of the House here in Florida, as you mentioned, and that involves setting the agenda. And we were able to really build the free state of Florida during those 2 years. We put more conservative wins on the board, more consequential legislation than we've seen really in Florida's history. You know, school choice, universal school choice, pushing back on ESG, ending corporate welfare, standing up for life, human life, and the Heartbeat Protection Act, making sure that we protected Second Amendment rights through constitutional carry, ending litigation abuse that's caused our insurance to skyrocket and it's now starting to settle down, and many, many other things, protecting our children against online pornography and addictive social media platforms were just some of the things that I was very directly involved in making sure were crafted and passed through the legislature to go to the governor's desk for signature.
Which is great. And I think that compared to what we've seen with the Florida legislature, you know, in the last term under the current Speaker of the House, that has for some bizarre reason just opposed Governor DeSantis, basically simply to oppose him. It's not a principled based opposition or actually trying, you know, to make legislation better. I think that's really frustrating overall. But what do you think about the property tax issue? I know that that's been the really big focus here in Florida, and there have been proposals in a number of other states, including Texas, to basically say, you know, hey, we as citizens should be able to own our property outright and not have to continue to basically pay rent to the government in the form of property tax.
So we released our Florida First affordability plan, and first up is property taxes. They've grown twice as fast as people's incomes here in Florida, and they just can't keep up. Whether it's people on fixed income, first-time home buyers, it's really, really causing people, and I meet them during the campaign events that I do every day, that are leaving the state or contemplating leaving the state or just losing their homes outright, and that's unacceptable. And so government should never grow faster than our incomes can afford, but that's exactly what's happening here. And so we've got to make Florida affordable again. The proposals that the House has and the governor's proposal to possibly eliminate all homestead property taxes will have to go to the ballot next November, and we won't feel that until November of 2027 when that next property tax bill comes out. That's 2 years from now, and so my position, Jenna, is that's too late. We need to do something right now to give people relief. So I'm calling for having in this affordability plan, and will again today at an event in Tampa, for a immediate rollback. This was done back in 2006-07 by the legislature. The legislature can do this and have a mandatory rollback in every county, depending on how that county's responded over the last 5 years. If you've been conservative and you've given money back to people, you'll have a smaller rollback. If you're one of these blue-leaning counties that has raised every tax they possibly could, you'll have a bigger rollback. And make sure we hold that for the next 2 years so everybody gets a break. This is all across property taxes, not just homeowners, but businesses and those that are non-homestead, to make sure we stop the increases, but also give a meaningful tax break now. And I think that's very important. That's not been discussed yet. It can be done. It should be done.
And that's a really interesting proposal. I haven't heard that being discussed, and I think that is really important as a kind of stopgap to give some relief now before, as you mentioned, that initiative would have to go to the ballot next year and then not actually see that relief until 2027. So, you know, sounds like a good plan to me. And, you know, one of the things that our current CFO, Blazin Golia, has been so prolific in exposing is how much waste and corruption there really is on the local level where property taxes go, because none of it goes to the state level. And so there is so much that can still be provided back to the people instead of wasted on things like, for example, Florida Doge posted the other day that the city of Orlando has spent in excess of $400,000 counting trees. And I'm thinking tax dollars shouldn't go to that. I mean, what possible benefit could that have? And there's so many examples of absolutely ridiculous, just pure waste.
Yeah, as conservatives, I think of the bullseye, the archery bullseye, and in the middle of the bullseye is public safety, our first responders, you know, and it grows out from there. But some of these nice to have things are what people think are nice to have, and I wouldn't even put trees in that category, but a lot of things that government does is not government's role. And so everything that government needs to do should be funded, but beyond that, it should be in our pockets. And so there's a lot of progress we can make. And as governor, I won't just doge local governments. I'll doge our own government, our state level government, our universities. There's a lot of waste and abuse in different corners, and the state is no exception. And so I want to see an even more fulsome, more robust DOGE effort that is continuing and ongoing. We ought to always be auditing and looking under the hood, and we're always scared at what we find, but those savings can be passed right along to taxpayers. When I was speaker, we had record tax relief to make sure that we returned it where it belongs to the people who paid it.
And my special guest this morning is Paul Renner, who is the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives and is currently running for governor. You can find more about him at VoteRenner, RENNER.com. And on that website, Paul, you under the Issues tab, you have two primary things, health and freedom. And I want to ask you about both of those categories, because I think that that really encapsulates what a lot of Floridians want and frankly expect to continue for Florida, especially as we saw what happened in other states during the wake of COVID and this abuse of emergency powers, and how the governors in many instances, like in California, just assumed the powers of the legislature to make life utterly terrible for people. And Governor DeSantis had a different track. So what's your vision on these overall issues of health and freedom?
Well, I was endorsed by Stand for Health Freedom, the leading organization on this issue. And I'll just say this. COVID was the biggest infringement on our civil liberties in our nation's history. And as governor, I will never, ever allow that to take place here in Florida. We will stand for freedom against mandates, whatever, wherever they come. And it's the same people who gave us Obamacare, the same people who have given us COVID lockdowns. And so it's really about making sure that whether it's vaccine mandates, you know, back when we were younger, when I was younger anyway, you're younger than me, but I had, you know, 10 shots and they were for things that would kill you. Now it's 50, 60, 70 that the CDC recommends and the Department of Health mandates. And a lot of these kids are getting multiple shots very early in life, and they're experiencing some vaccine injuries, some symptoms that can't really be explained. And so we need to really be careful and make sure that we give parents the full information, the cost and the benefits of vaccines, and let a parent and a pediatrician have that conversation, not the CDC and a pediatrician and dictating to a parent. So I want to make sure that in everything, part of that plan is also AI protections in schools for our parents. We have to put our parents in control of what their kids are seeing, what kind of medical treatment or mental health treatment they're getting without our knowledge or consent. And we will stand strong for parental rights. That's a big portion of that health, freedom, and wellness initiative, but also just good meals, you know, making sure we partner with farmers to deliver great meals, physical fitness, having a governor's physical fitness program as part of that proposal that I have. And it's on our website, and we've had a lot of media around it, and I'm excited about it. It's part of what we need to be doing, as well as attacking this affordability problem that we have in Florida.
And that website is VoteRenner.com. And quickly, in just about the last minute that we have, you know, Byron Donalds is currently leading the polls. However, you can see that he's not really popular in Florida and hasn't really answered questions like why he didn't stand up for pro-life and against Amendment 4, and also, you know, against corporate takeover with the whole weed agenda with Amendment 3, some of these things. And so overall on those issues, you know, pro-life especially, I think that's incredibly important. So your response on that, just in the last minute we have.
There's no more pro-life candidate in this race than this one, than me. And the Heartbeat Protection Act was done because, again, as Speaker, you can really craft this agenda, and I insisted that we protect life and have the most pro-life legislation that I believe we could have in Florida and still be sustained. And as you know, there's a 57% vote, just close to the 60% threshold, to have unrestricted abortion up to the moment of birth, taxpayer-funded. And I also wasn't in my job description, but I led an effort. I spent and raised over $2 million to stop Amendment 4, this extreme abortion amendment. I spoke, I did op-eds, I traveled the state. There's no more pro-life candidate that actually did things to stop that amendment, and we needed everybody. The governor did a great job, and many of us, but there were a lot of politicians that were missing in action, and you've said it, and they say pro-life things on the campaign trail to get our vote, but when it comes time to standing on principle, they're nowhere to be found, and so I will always stand for life without question.
Well, I really appreciate that, and really appreciate this conversation. We'll have to have you back on again soon, Paul Renner. And again, you can go to voterenner.com. You should follow him on social media and stay up to date on that campaign. And also, this week, don't forget about Operation Christmas Child during National Collection Week. That goes through until the 24th. And you can fill those shoeboxes. Go to samaritanspurse.org/OCC. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.